Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
A Tempest at Sea, Chapter 1, April 1887. "There's something you're not telling me, Ash," said Charlotte Holmes. The night was starless, the sky low and heavy, but spring was beginning to make itself felt as a certain fullness in the air, the swelling of blackthorn buds and the cusp of flowering. Charlotte was warmly wrapped in an Inverness cape, a deerstalker cap on her head. No one who saw her in her masculine attire now, if anyone could see in the pitch blackness, would have mistaken her for the pink, silk-clad vixen who had successfully ambushed Lord Ingram Ashburton earlier in the evening. It had been their first meeting since her terribly inauspicious death in Cornwall, where her body was said to have been dissolved in a vat of perchloric acid. Her closest associates had mourned in a manner befitting those who could not publicly acknowledge their grief. But they had also worried in truth, as weeks wore on, that no news from her. Charlotte, even before she had been advised to stay away from her usual haunts following that spectacle on the Cornish coast, had decided on a safe haven, none other than Eastleigh Park, the country seat of the Duke of Wycliffe, Lord Ingram's eldest brother. The estate's hunting lodge had proved a peaceful abode for her, of course an excellent location in which to lie in wait for Lord Ingram to turn up for his usual Easter visit. And now, after a few highly pleasurable hours becoming reacquainted in his bedroom in the main residence, he was escorting her back to the hunting lodge, as she could not be seen in his quarters come morning, whether as a man or a woman. The night was thick as a wall. She walked blindly, but he had grown up on this estate and ambled along, guiding her with an occasional touch on her elbow or the small of her back. "I'll tell you when we're inside," he said in response to his earlier comment, his tone deliberately light. But when they entered the hunting lodge and lit a few sconces, he did not divulge what he kept from her. Instead, he left with a hand candle to make sure that the structure, bigger than her ancestral home, was free from hidden intruders. Charlotte removed her caped coat and prosthetic paunch, strolled into the drawing room, and searched out on a settee the gold brocade upholstery, of which was visibly fraying. The hunting lodge, an opulent addition to the estate 150 years ago, had not been improved in at least two generations. He returned, handed a biscuit tin to her, crossed the room to a padded chair upholstered in the same worn brocade, and leaned against its rounded armrest, one leg straight, the other half bent. He was rarely so informal in his posture, but even so, his shoulders remained open, his weight evenly distributed. He lifted his head and seemed about to speak, but didn't. A single lamp bronzed the antlers mounted above the door and delineated shadows in the hall of his cheeks. Charlotte opened the tin and nibbled at the almond macaroon and waited, though she had already guessed what he was going to tell her. It was not about Moriarty. Her lover was distracted, but not yet alarmed. Still, the matter made him concerned for her safety, a task that required her to leave Eastleigh Park then. A task for Sherlock Holmes? And who could make such a request and be sure that he would, in fact, relay it to her?
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, and today I'm here with Sherry Thomas, and we're going to talk about her latest book in her Lady Sherlock series, A Tempest at Sea. Sherry, thanks for being here with me today.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you.
So this is, as I said, the latest in your series. It's book number 7. So I thought before we got into the book itself, you could maybe And we can talk about sort of the series itself, but can we talk first about how you got interested in writing this Lady Sherlock series and creating Charlotte Holmes and bringing, it's not a contemporary version, right? It's a historical version still, but making Sherlock Holmes a female.
Oh, right. So I like most people who read Sherlock Holmes early in life, I was like, ooh, this is so cool. I grew up in China. And so I first read Sherlock Holmes translated into Chinese when I was like a preteen. But right around the time I was being introduced to the original story, I came across a copy of The 7% Solution, also translated into Chinese. And for people who are not that familiar with Sherlock Holmes pastiche, which is basically Sherlock Holmes stories written by someone other than Arthur Conan Doyle, and there is a ton of it. The 7% Solution is sort of like a landmark book in the pastiche. It was like, when it came out, it spent like weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. I think it came out in the early 80s or something like that. And it kind of like, even though I was really young, even though I had no literary critique skills whatsoever at the time, as a reader, I just thought it was really cool because in the original canon, Sherlock Holmes' drug abuse was just, you know, taken as a matter of fact. Yeah, he has nothing to do. So he's shooting himself up with, you know, the 7% solution of cocaine. It was cocaine, right? But in the 7% solution, apparently they treated it quite differently. They treated it much more seriously. And Sherlock Holmes disappeared for 3 years. Why did he disappear for this? He was actually in a Swiss rehab, you know, trying to dry himself out. And I remember reading as, you know, like an 11-year-old just thinking, wow, that actually makes so much sense because, like, you know, he was druggy and he probably does want to clean up at some point. It's just really difficult to imagine that you could just randomly shoot yourself up without somehow the drug from taking over your life. So I'd always been as interested in what other people wrote about Sherlock Holmes as, you know, what original Arthur Conan Doyle wrote. Then back in 2005, I came across Laurie R. King's Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes books, in which she gave Sherlock Holmes, the author gave Sherlock Holmes, an equal female partner, a lot younger, but he's equal in every way, in mind, in temperament, in like fortitude. And I thought that was so cool. And for the very first time, I thought, oh, I would love to write something like this, a new take on Sherlock Holmes that's, you know, retains a lot of the mystique and of the original, but like totally updated for our time and just very interesting in the creativity and the new world building it brings. But then I thought, I'm probably not very good at writing plot because I was just a very new romance writer at the time. I mean, I've been writing romance for a while, but that I had just been bought by a New York house and was about to embark on a career as a romance writer. So I thought, okay, maybe let me hold off on this a bit. And then fast forward a few years to BBC Sherlock. By the time I saw BBC Sherlock, the one with Benedict Cumberbatch, and I was like, wow, this is really doing such a great job updating it for the new century and everything. And I just love it. And at that time, I just had more confidence in myself as a plotter. And also, I was coming to the end of my ideas of, you know, historical romance. I was like, I first proposed this idea to my young adult publisher. And if they had taken it, mine would have been like a girl Sherlock. It would have been a contemporary adaptation. But they were like, we don't think mysteries typically don't sell very well in YA. So then I was like, Okay, fair enough, because that's what we're in the business to sell books. If they don't sell very well in YA, then I turned around to my adult publisher and said, how about you guys? And they said, bring it on. They offered me a 3-book contract, and I thought, if I was going to write for the adult fiction market, then I might as well capitalize on the fact that I've been writing other novels set in the late Victorian period. Fortunately, that's exactly the same time setting as the Sherlock Holmes books. So I was like, okay, I'm already familiar with that time period, and my readers probably expect more historical fiction from me. So let's make this one for the grown-ups a historical adaptation. Except, oh yeah, by the time I thought I wanted to write my own, I was looking at BBC Sherlock and it's like, what else is there to be done? You know, they already brought him up to the 21st century. They already, over at CBS on Elementary, they already made Watson a woman. It seemed like the only thing left was to make Sherlock a woman. I look around, it hasn't happened yet, at least not maybe in fan fiction, but not in traditional publishing. And I was like, great, let me do it.
And you're, I'm going to guess your YA publishers are probably kicking themselves now, because now we have a YA female Sherlocks, right? We have, like, you were a little ahead of the time.
So yeah. They may not be kicking themselves at all. They may be thinking, great, so we avoid like having two YA Sherlock Holmes adaptation at the same time. My YA publisher actually read my grown-up Lady Sherlock book and liked them a lot. But I don't think she regrets, you know, because it would have come out at the same time, exactly the same time as the other one.
Yeah. So this is, as you said, this is book 7. And so can you kind of set us up? So at this point in your series, there's been some issues. And so Charlotte has to go into hiding and has to disguise herself. And so can you kind of, and what's a great, and I'll say this too, a great thing about this series, at least with this book, is if you know some of the story of Sherlock, if you know that, you don't need to have read all of the books to enter into this book, right? But there is some sort of background and with this. So can you kind of set us up before we get into the book itself about like sort of what has happened in the past with your characters and with Charlotte Holmes and in this world?
Charlotte Holmes, my titular Lady Sherlock, kind of became Sherlock Holmes, the consulting detective, because she was kicked out of society, you know, because she is sort of a persona non grata, became after some random mishaps that, you know, plans that didn't go well. So she was basically not yet out on the streets, but she had run away from home and she was on her own. And she fortunately ran into Mrs. Watson, who took her under her wing and put up the finances, recognize this extraordinary talent, which Charlotte herself didn't know what to do with, because she is a gently raised young lady who had never been taught how to, you know, monetize her talents. But Mrs. Watson had been through life, and Mrs. Watson had been on stage. She's not shy to talk about money and how to make a living. So she actually put up the finances. So, you know, Sherlock Holmes, consulting detective, could open its doors and take clients. And their conceit was that there's this great genius named Sherlock Holmes, but he is, you know, he has some mysterious and debilitating injuries that he can only like be like next door on his convalescent bed. And Charlotte Holmes plays his sister and Oracle, that she's the only one who can communicate with him. And then, you know, she listens to the clients and she takes their problems, inside the bedroom to him to consult, you know, the non-existent Sherlock Holmes and come back and tell them, you know, this is what the great consulting detective says. But, you know, it's really all Charlotte all the time. And so, of course, in a modern day adaptation of Sherlock Holmes, you can't not have Moriarty. So we also have the overarching story with this is like Moriarty's shadow slowly creeps into Charlotte Holmes' life. And in the previous book, they actually met for the first time in book 6. And so now, as a result of everything that happened up to then, yeah, as you said, Charlotte is in hiding. She is kind of lying low. And she receives an offer that basically says, if you can do this for the British Crown, retrieve a certain document, then, you know, maybe we can extend our protection to you a little bit, and then you can go back to living a normal life, don't have to, you know, hide from Moriarty anymore. And she said, oh, that sounds appealing. So she goes on, she goes to find this MacGuffin, and the MacGuffin leads her onto the RMS Provence, which is headed east toward India and Australia and points further east. And while she's on this ship trying to find this dossier, a murder happens. Now, normally, if a murder happens, you would say, let's call Sherlock Holmes to investigate, but she is in disguise. So her thing is she's trying not to get too caught up in this. She wants to find out what happened, but she cannot have what she's doing on the ship or the fact that she's traveling incognito found out by, you know, the people who, by the Scotland Yard investigator who also actually happens to be on board and who's been given charge of this case. So it's a game of cat and mouse, not only between the detective and the murderer, but between Charlotte and people who are running the actual murder investigation.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things that I really wanted to talk to you about. Like, one is, I think she's in disguise, and throughout this, she and Mrs. Watson are both in disguise, and are playing these characters, and sometimes they switch off. And so when you put them in disguise and when you thought about this, did you also think about what are the, you know, in the late 1800s, and during this time period, what do can I use to make this disguise realistic, right? We don't have tons of like prosthetics and all of this we can put on. So can you talk a little bit about that, putting her in disguise in this sort of, on sea, right? On this ship that's sort of a captive space and audience.
Charlotte is in disguise as a very old lady. Or at least a lady who isn't that old, but who is very wrinkly. You know, all the wrinkle is kind of to disguise the contours of her own face. I was a fan of the Lord of the Rings books and the movies, and I remember watching the behind the scenes on the extended cut of the movie, the DVD, the big ass DVD that you used to be able to buy. There was a very interesting segment about how they made the Rohan King look so old and then make him go back into a young man again. So the actor is not that old, but how they made him look so old was through a practical effect, not a digital effect. Basically, they just use tissue paper and dipped in the solution and stick it to his face. And when it dries, it forms very realistic looking wrinkles. So then I thought I could do something similar. She has a friend who's like a great chemist, and you know they could come up with a solution, like skin tone solution for that. And so she could disguise herself, and she's also taking advantage of the fact that people probably wouldn't look too closely at a wrinkly old woman. So she's using the fact that, you know, older women kind of sort of become invisible to the general populace also to like make sure her, you know, nobody's looking at her too closely.
Right. And so another thing that I really thought was fascinating and appears in this book, and I'm going to assume in the others, some that I haven't read, is her family is involved in this. So she has a sister, Olivia, and her mother, who is quite the character herself. And so could you talk a little bit about this family dynamic that you created for Charlotte and sort of the Holmes family and some of these characters?
Right. The Holmes family is quite the dysfunctional family. The parents kind of hate each other, but, you know, must carry on for appearances' sakes. And they are both disappointed that they only have daughters. There are four daughters in the family. And we only meet two of them in this book, but there are four daughters. The oldest one's married. The second oldest is severely autistic and cannot look after herself, must be looked after all the time. And the third sister's name is Livia. Livia plays the traditional Dr. Watson role in the sense that she is Charlotte's chronicler. She's the one who writes the Sherlock Holmes stories based on Charlotte. And there's Charlotte, who is the youngest, and for the longest time, she was thought maybe she might turn out the same as her second eldest sister, the autistic one, because she also didn't talk and was like very, was a very odd little girl. But the general dynamic is their parents do not like having so many girls, and they do not value the girls. And Charlotte has never really cared. She values herself plenty. But Livia has very much been affected by this disdain that she's received her whole life. So she is the one who has to struggle against parental expectation and scorn, whereas Charlotte, being Sherlock Holmes, does not give a damn. she has worth in her own eyes. She doesn't even have to think about her worth. Yeah.
And you found a way to sort of bring Livia and bring Lady Holmes on board, and her mother is really a piece of work, right?
Mother, like, as I was writing it, I realized her mother is the Uber Karen, you know, because yeah. When I was writing this book, Karens were in the news all the time, and I was writing, I was like, wait a minute, she is like the Uber Karen.
Yes, and very much also like dedicated to making people know or think that she has money and she has a societal space and place in these ways. Like, she's one of those characters that you really want to hate, but you still want to read more of, right? Like, you hate her so much, but you want her there because she's a great character, right?
Right, because she's one of those characters who actually does things, even if they're stupid things. She does things that push the plot along. Yes. You go like, holy smoke, I can't believe she did that.
Yes, but you're like, but it makes total sense. And I love and having her sort of her lady in waiting, her servants with her, and like knowing like everybody feels bad for every run around her all the time. Right. Yes.
Right. Poor Livia has to attend dance attendance on her. Charlotte being in disguise, nobody knows she's on the ship. It's fair that at least.
Yes. So you have this family that you've created and brought in, and you've also, as a romance author, right? We need a love interest.
Well, we need a love interest.
Of course. And so can you talk a little bit about that too? And the love interest and it seems like there has been in the previous, they are finally able to, at least when they're in disguise, be together. But that was not always the case. So can you talk a little bit about the romance that you bring in?
Right. So the romance in this, the main romance between in the series is between Charlotte Holmes and this lovely gentleman named Lord Ingram Ashburton. At the beginning of the series, Lord Ingram was actually married. And so sometime in the series, he became a free man. He already has two children. They've known each other, not their whole lives, but they've known each other since they were teenagers. And they've had maintained a correspondence for many years going. And she has always been very interested in him, in not necessarily in a romantic sense, but she has always like viewed him as her way to explore sexuality and everything that else that was forbidden, you know, otherwise forbidden to a Victorian young lady. And he has always viewed her as an agent of chaos, which, you know, he correctly did. And, you know, for a long time, he very much wanted to find his place in the hierarchy. He didn't want to abandon the hierarchy as she did. He very much wanted to have a place and hold on to it, you know, like to be accepted in the world by the world he knows. So he viewed her, although I believe he was always being attracted to her, he also viewed her as dangerous and, you know, absolutely not the kind of, you know, woman anyone ought to, you know, not anyone ought not to, but at least he could not get involved with, because they seem to want completely different things in life. And so that the thing that stood between them, you know, in the beginning, it would appear to be his marriage, but it's actually a lot more than just his marriage. It's two fundamentally different ways of looking at the world. It's two fundamentally different ways of wanting to live and what you want out of life. And so it is only as, you know, various things happen to him and happen to her and happen to them, or they do things together, that that they change slowly. I think he more than her. To come to see that, okay, what he had valued so much, what he had wanted so much, the place in the hierarchy, may not necessarily be the thing that would make him happy after all. That maybe he would be happier if he actually instead learned to step out of, you know, all the societal expectations on which that had weighed so heavily on him for so much of his life.
Right. So you have this romance, and you kind of mentioned another thing that I thought was interesting is, and I think, I don't know if part of this is because they're at sea, we see a lot of the class divide, right? And how sort of you can move back and forth, like Charlotte and Mrs. Watson were able to sort of, in disguising themselves, move between sort of the servants' quarters and as well as sort of on deck with the with the paying passengers who were there. And so can you talk a little bit about that too, and sort of looking at or being able to balance or use that sort of class divide during this time period in your novel?
Yeah, in the Victorian era, I think even now in the UK, the class divide is like huge. And I think at that time, you know, people, especially I think people of the upper class, the middle class, they just kind of take it for granted that they were better people because of, you know, a lot of them just took it for granted that they were better people because of who their parents were and or who they married to, or, you know, like at least better than them, whoever that them would be. And I think Lady Holmes, Charlotte Holmes's mother is very much example of that, that sense of like, you know, she not only feels superior to just about everybody on the ship, but like her sense of superiority is part of who she is. If she didn't have that, she would have nothing. Because really her finances are precarious. And so there's not only that, but there's also the divide between the old money and new money. Because we have on the ship a Australian millionaire and his sister, they're going back to Australia. And the Australian millionaire came from nothing. And his presence is like very much like a thorn in the side for for Lady Holmes, because, you know, she just couldn't stand it how this man pays her no respect and just like, and that she can do nothing about him because he's rich on his own. He doesn't need her to employ him or to anything for him. Yeah.
Yeah, and there is, as you're talking about too, there's this idea that because there's sort of new money and because the sister did not have the means growing up, that automatically we can look at her as a suspect, right? We can look at them as suspects because, of course, it would not be anyone with status or class that
to look at. It's the investigation. You automatically look at, you know, okay, the... it's no surprise to tell people that, you know, it's Australian millionaire who was murdered. And of course the suspicion immediately fall on those who might need money, who might want his money for themselves. You know, people always suspect the people of lower standing, and never, you know, the people who have proper status.
Yeah, no, I love cool stuff. I don't know if I loved, but I really liked. So there was a point where Mrs. Watson befriends the sister on deck, and Mrs. Watson then is worried that, like, would the character she's playing, the person who she's playing in real life, be bothered by her, like Watson befriending this woman of sort of lower status and lower class. And I thought that is an important commentary, an important thing to think about that, I mean, still goes on today, but to think about like how much that class and status plays out.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It like appearances were so important to people back then. I mean, it is still so important to people today. Otherwise, we wouldn't have social media, right? So social media is basically all about appearances. It's just appearances are still so important, just we're manifesting it in different ways.
Right. So another thing. So you have these characters. You have these great characters. Moriarty is not in the book, but his presence is well known throughout. So right. And you've sort of created this huge sort of network of, you know, for him. So can you talk a little bit about that decision and sort of how you've made this kind of this larger this larger network of his people, his minions, I guess.
Right. Because Moriarty in the original canon was actually there only in like three or four stories. He was not mentioned very much at all. I think he was mainly dredged up so that so that Arthur Conan Doyle, when he got fed up of writing Sherlock Holmes stories, could just kill off Sherlock Holmes. But of course, the Victorian reading population didn't let him do it. They basically more or less forced him to bring Sherlock Holmes back from the dead. So basically, all we know about Moriarty is that he's this great criminal mastermind. Well, you can't really be called a mastermind, like, if all you have is yourself, right? So it kind of implies that he has people who will do his bidding. Otherwise, what is he masterminding? And so that I have set it up so that he is kind of at the center of an international web that, you know, he does have his people in Britain, but he's also there on the continent. And I don't quite have it that he has a finger in every pie, but he has enough fingers in enough pies that, you know, Charlotte has somehow managed to run into his influence for several books running. So far, like until book six, he has been like sort of a peripheral character. They kind of run into his influence. They kind of run into his people, but they hadn't run into himself. So this whole Lady Sherlock books are typically very tightly connected one to the other. So far the books have all been kind of like on the Moriarty arc. Like, so how, you know, we keep running into him. So then now the question has slowly, earlier they were trying to avoid him. They were trying to just like, ooh, let's not be any more involved with him, accidentally involved with him than we have to. But now it's slowly turned arc. So like, okay, what can we do to take him down? And this book, although not in the main concern with Moriarty, still certain things happen to advance what they want to do against Moriarty. Certain things fall into place.
So you've got this. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about like what you decided to. So we talked a little bit about sort of the canon and how you've sort of adopted some of that. So what else, like in your series, are there certain stories of Sherlock Holmes? Are there certain experiences that you really wanted to bring in a new light or give sort of a new angle to, or ones that you chose to sort of shy away from and change?
Well, I like in the first book can be the first book in the series, A Study in Scarlet Women, can be said to be a loose adaptation of A Study in Scarlet, because it's also a revenge story. So for later books, you know, at first for book two, I went back to the original canon and said, is there anything I can adapt? And well, first of all, mostly he wrote short stories, which are not that easy to adapt into full-length novels. And of his full-length novels, yeah, none of them are particularly in the direction I would like to go to. I don't want to rewrite the Hound of Baskerville or anything like that. Or the Sign of the Four. So then it became more of the exploration of my own characters. Like, it's the Sherlock-ness of Charlotte that is often explored. And it's interesting to explore that, because in a man, you take those characteristics for granted. But in a woman, that is, you know, not only unusual, back then it was considered outré. It was just like, who is this strange, strange woman? And, you know, why does she think the way she does? Why does she act the way she does? So Charlotte basically has to deal with a lot more than Sherlock Holmes ever did for being the exact same person. And I also wanted to explore, like, how would a woman grow up differently? Like, if Sherlock Holmes was born into a Victorian woman's body, he's not going to grow up into the exact same person, simply because he would not have led the same life. Even if you started with the same material, everything you experience in life also make you who you are, right? So he would have had a lot more pressure in his life to conform to a certain standard. He would have had a lot more pressure to like be a certain way, act a certain way, get married. You know, like Sherlock Holmes was a confirmed bachelor. Like, you know, nobody, at least according to Dr. Watson, nobody ever seemed to have been like banging down his door telling him it is time for you to get married, you know, blah, blah, blah. He never seemed to have experienced any of that. But you cannot be a woman back then and not, you know, especially you cannot be a woman from a certain, you know, socioeconomic class where you're not supposed to work, you're not supposed to labor for your own support. So then what choice do you have in life for your livelihood? You know, unless your parents can give you something or you marry another man who promises to support you, you know, for as long as you both shall live. So, you know, all those things, the book ends up being more about the exploration of those things than like what Arthur Conan Doyle wrote. But which I think is fine because that's the whole point of rewriting these literary classics, because we want them to reflect our time, not, you know, their original time, because they already reflected the original time when they were written.
Yes, I loved throughout Charlotte knew that the character, Charlotte loves sweets, but she knew the character she was playing would not be eating those. So there was these lovely moments where she was excited to get like that her lover had brought her like cake, or she would sneak food when people weren't looking. So she
could have
the sweets, like these kinds of things that.
Right. This series of book is known for Charlotte's gourmandise, you know, her appetite. And I would often introduce various baked goods or pastries, you know, into her, you know, not her cooking repertoire because she doesn't cook, but her eating repertoire. And so this time someone actually asked, oh, I can't wait to see what new treats Charlotte get to experience in this book. And I had to tell her, this is the book where, you know, Charlotte can't eat that much because the person she's in disguise as supposedly has the appetite of a bird. And so she has to eat very carefully while in public, but in private, sometimes, as this is a book she gets like office work party leftovers. It's like basically at the police interrogation, the ship always makes sure that the police officer and his and Lord Ingram, who's acting as his, you know, secretary and note taker, has enough to eat. And Lord Ingram would steal that and bring it back to his room, and so Charlotte can wolf them down.
Which is great, right? Because you get to see that. Like, I love that you get to kind of see that playfulness or see those desires in her really having to think about, all right, I need to stay in character all the time, but I also really want to eat something.
Yeah.
So also, you put this at sea, right? You put this on a ship. So there aren't many places you can go, many places you can hide. So she's in disguise and she's stuck on this ship. Why did you choose to put them on at sea?
It's a question I'm still asking myself. I asked myself that question many times in the writing of this book because it just seemed like, you know, she was in disguise. Like, what could she do? After six books on land, I kind of wanted them to be somewhere else. And on the high seas seemed like a great idea at the time. I mean, it did turn out to be a great idea. I feel this book is, you know, turned out to be well executed. But while I was trying to figure out this ship, it was so hard to find like naval architecture from the 1880s. Like, I could find all kinds of ship, like, you know, deck plans from the 1860s. And there are just so many, you know, plans and pictures, everything from the 1890s. But 1880 was like a vacuum. It was just like, you know, and I keep telling the story that I finally, I know that there are certain historical ships that existed. And I finally found a place that had a, like, basically a brochure that they gave to the passengers online, a brochure that had been preserved, so that would show the deck plans of the ship. And it was on this like naval memorabilia website, and it would cost me $500, you know, to buy it. And I was like, you know what? No. I was like, now that I know it costs $500 and I know people cannot access it that easily, I am going to design my own ship based on what I know of ships from the earlier decades and ship that came a few years later. And if anybody wants to tell me I am wrong, they have to first pay $500 to get that little deck plan. And ships have different designs. You cannot say all ships have the same design. So I feel mine would not be far off. So it was like difficult to write because without a plan, I didn't even know where anybody was in relationship to anyone else. And for something like this, when everybody was like stuck together in a small space, you really needed to know where people were at all times, or at least the author needed to know where people are at all times so that she could move pieces around, like who might have seen who didn't see who, you know. So part of the reason I also wanted this was because I enjoyed Death on the Nile as much as anyone else so who reads mystery, Agatha Christie's. And I was always like, that'd be so cool to do something like that. So now I have done something like that.
Yeah, I was going to add because I wanted to know about the ship. And, you know, in the beginning, as many books start kind of like this, you have the diagram of kind of where everyone was staying. But I wanted to know, like, yes, did you draw for yourself visual aid?
I drew it on a piece of construction paper, and I had a couple of different deck plans from different ships, actual ships stuck on the back, so I could turn around and consult. And there are certain ones online that I consulted also as I was drawing it up. So it's like on paper, and then I, you know, send PDFs to my publisher and say, could you like clean this up and, you know, professionally draft this? And they did. It was turned out very nice.
Yeah, because there are times when it's like, well, to get from here to here, or you have to go through this location to get there. And yes, and when you're in a confined space, you need, like you said, as the author, you need to know where everything is at every time.
Anything you didn't know, for example, where the stairwell is. So like, you know, like, okay, people going up and down the stairs, you know, who they might see and those stuff like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was like, sometimes it's one of those things where, you get to try something new and sometimes it works, you know, and it works out, but it can be really difficult to do it as you're doing it. to write that. So we've been talking about your book for a while, and I probably could talk about this longer, but I will ask you, this book is just out, but are you working on, the Lady Sherlock series is not ended, I'm going to guess, right?
I just signed a contract to do books 8 and 9, so I am in the middle of working on book 8, yes, which is emphatically not set on a ship.
They've gotten off the ship. Yes. And that was the other thing during this time period, which is great, is that like they're not only on the ship, but they can't really get a hold of anyone. They don't have a coroner, right? They can't.
There's no ship to land or ship to ship telegraph. That would not be available for like another a good many years before they will have that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there's all these kind of pieces where they're kind of stuck in this space and have to figure things out. And Charlotte also can't come out and just be like, hey, I am here. I'm going to tell you this. So has to figure out the ways in which she can reveal and get support from others on the ship to help her sort of solve this mystery. Right. Like there's all these lovely layers.
Yes. But we also technologically they were advanced enough that, you know, once they reach port and it is like 5 days from Southampton to Gibraltar. So once they reach port, they can immediately send out all kinds of, you know, cables going to different corners of the world, asking for information from Australia, from UK, from elsewhere. And, you know, those would get there fast and come back fast. So I think the existence of electricity and telegraph was part of the reason when I wrote my historical romances, I also set them late in the 19th century and not much earlier when you still have to, you know, just basically like rely on letters. I was like, cool, technology. Yes.
So we've got more of Lady Holmes coming. Is there anything else that you're working on that you want folks to know about?
I was given another book in the contract. I say I was given because the publisher said, we have this idea. Do you want to write it? And I was like, hey, why not? I don't know whether I can talk about it yet because I haven't heard my publisher mention anything. But yes, I will be, besides writing Lady Sherlock 8 and 9, I will be working on something else. So, you know, next time we talk, we might be talking about some non-Lady Sherlock stuff.
Well, it has been so wonderful talking to you about this book and this series. And I will say, for people who have not read anything in the series yet, you can jump in. I read number 7 and I was able to jump in and had a great time with Charlotte and her gang. But there is, you can also go back and read 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
If you must, I feel 7 is an okay point to jump in. It's weird. Like, people have jumped in at various points and said, yeah, we managed to understand, you know, just fine and follow the plot. But I think if you start from the beginning, you will get all the nuances of character development and, you know, and see, like, how things that were, you thought was one way in this book may have turned out differently in a different book and so on and so forth. It just become a big overarching story. So yes, I do think you can jump in through book 7, but I would also encourage readers to, you know, pick up with book 1. Then you also, if you like it, you have more books to read.
Yes. Well, and I will say that, like, reading book 7, reading A Tempest at Sea made me want to go back because I did want to follow that arc. I'm like, how did we get to this point? And as I said, her mother is someone you always want to, like, just probably slap, but I'm like, is this woman like this the whole time? Right. So there's all these little things that make you want to go back and start at the beginning, as all good mystery series that you sort of enter in the middle do, right? Oh, you want to go back and start at the beginning and then keep going. So you can see how we got to where we were.
Thank you very, very much.
So again, thank you so much for talking with me for New Books Network. Sherry Thomas, who is the author of the Lady Sherlock series, and we were talking about her latest in the series, A Tempest at Sea.
Thank you very, very much, Rebecca, for having me. You have a lovely day.
You too.